Hi everyone, thank you for joining us for this online webinar held virtually, obviously at the International Inequalities Institute. The webinar is called Culture is Bad for You, Inequality in the Cultural and Creative Industries. I'm Dr. Sarah Camacho-Felix. I'm an assistant professorial lecturer at the III and I'll be chairing the event. Our speaker is Dr. Dave O'Brien, who is a Chancellor's Fellow, Cultural and Creative Industries at the University of Edinburgh, and he'll be introducing themes from his new book of the same name, which analyzes some of the connections between culture and social inequality. It presents the first large-scale study of social mobility in the cultural and creative jobs, along with hundreds of interviews with cultural workers and a new analysis of secondary data sets showing who works and who engages in culture is deeply unequal. We're going to begin with a 40-minute presentation, followed by 20 minutes of questions, and the event will last until 1:30 p.m. British Summer Time. Just to let you know, later on this week, there will be a public event on Thursday, the 15th of October at 5:30 p.m. called Is the Economy Racist? With speakers Faiza Shaheen, who's the director of class, Wilf Sullivan, who is the Equalities Officer for the Trade Unions Congress, Nolanla Makuyana, who is from the Decolonizing Economics, and it will be chaired by Dr. Purnima Padipati from the Department of Sociology. To see more upcoming events with the III, please see the link in the chat function. And you can also find out more about what's going on at the III this term by signing up to the newsletter, which will include the registration link in the chat as well. Before I hand over to Dave, just to say, if you have any questions during the presentation, please put them in the Q&A box. And at this moment, I will hand it over to Dr. Dave O'Brien.
Thanks. Thanks for that introduction. Thanks for inviting me to talk about the book, which, sharing my screen, which came out last month. I'm one of the co-authors with Orion Brook, who's also at the University of Edinburgh, and also Mark Taylor, who works at the University of Sheffield. We cover quite a lot of ground in the book. We talk about lots of different things, both in terms of patterns in cultural production, so the labour force, and also patterns in cultural consumption, both in terms of attendances and participation in a range of different activities. So rather than kind of like trying to squeeze everything into one short talk, I thought I'd pick out a few themes that might be of interest for this session, and particularly thinking about particular kinds of intersecting inequalities. I have to admit as well, as part of the book, we've highlighted particular themes in other settings. And so it's quite nice to be able to talk about things like gender and parenting for this talk today. So I'll start off just by thinking about a couple of patterns that we might observe in the workforce for culture in the UK. One of the things we try and establish quite early on in the book is that we can use nationally representative data from the Office for National Statistics Labour Force Survey to show that in some cultural occupations, there are really serious kind of imbalances and issues associated with gender, race, and social class, which are the sort of three areas that we highlight in the book. And they're the three areas that I guess the three of us as authors know about in most detail, although obviously they're not the only demographic categories that matter. Also, we can show that even where we've got maybe kind of good news stories about particular cultural and creative occupations that maybe have got, you know, a better gender balance or doing better in terms of, say, class or racial representation, when we drill down using things like interview field work, we find that, you know, our kind of national level stories need to be supplemented and need kind of nuance and details. So just to pick up a couple of things that are going to be elaborated on for the rest of this talk. If we look at the film, TV, video, radio, and photography occupations, these are the kinds of occupations that underpin creative activity in the film industry, we can see that there's a massive absence of women from these sets of occupations. And what's kind of depressing here is that not only are these occupations dominated by men, but we know from other research projects, such as the Calling the Shots project done by University of Southampton, Shirley Cobb and her colleagues, that particular occupations such as being a film director, being a film producer, see, you know, almost kind of, you know, total absences of women, particularly Black British women, things like women from working class origins as well. We can contrast this to museums, galleries and libraries. So, you know, occupations that include being a curator, a librarian. This workforce is dominated by women. You know, there's a significant absence of men from these occupations when we look at the kind of, you know, nationally representative labor force survey level. But again, you know, this only tells us part of the story. It only really tells us about the overall patterns in the workforce. It doesn't explain why it is that, for example, across the country, the kind of key leadership roles for, say, curators are generally staffed by men, and women seem to be, you know, making it into lower levels of these occupational hierarchies, but not really making it all the way to the top. And that's going to be a theme I'm going to unpack in quite a bit of detail shortly. Similar imbalances, different patterns with regard to race in the workforce. I'm not going to talk too much about that, but you can see things like publishing, things like our film occupations seem to have more white people than the rest of the workforce as a whole, although our music, performing, visual arts seem to be doing a bit better in terms of the kind of overall balance of inequalities with regard to race. And again, you know, this is something that I think these statistics are a really important starting point for telling the story of what our culture and creative workforce looks like, but they're not a finishing point. You know, they are not the end of the story, and I think that's really important. Similarly with social class, this is a slightly different visualization that tries to tell the story of social class origins in our cultural and creative occupations over a five-year period, 2014 to 2019. The darkest line represents those who are from managerial professional backgrounds, you know, the kind of most elite social origins, social starting points. And what we can see here is a dominance of these individuals in all of our cultural and creative occupations, aside from craft, and that's for sort of technical reasons about how craft is defined by the ONS, how craft occupations are categorized in the overall NSSEC classification system. About a third of people in the workforce are from managerial professional origins, but we can see that, let's, you know, take museums, although seemingly rates of working class representation, seemingly rates of professional managerial origin representation have been going down, rates of working class origin representation, that's about 29% of the population, are still quite low. Similarly, music, performing, visual arts, publishing, there's a blip in 2018, but again, it's quite a posh set of people constituting these occupations. So if these are our broad kind of patterns suggesting that particular cultural and creative occupations have real sort of issues with regard to gender inequality and racial inequality, and all cultural and creative occupations aside from craft have major issues with regard to class inequality, how do we partially explain these patterns, but can we also elaborate and add detail to these macro pictures from ONS data? So I'm going to pick out a couple of things. One thing to be aware of is that inequality starts really, really early in individuals' lives. We've got some useful data from the DCMS's, so that's the Department for Culture, Media and Sports Taking Part survey, where we see that those working in cultural and creative occupations were the most likely to report having been heavily involved in cultural activities as children. You know, they tell a story of cultural activities, cultural engagement being really, really important to them when they were growing up. And we can't draw a kind of a mechanistic, you know, causal relationship between this engagement and then working in a cultural and creative career. There are lots of other explanations for why people in cultural and creative occupations might highlight their childhood cultural engagement. But it's one indicator, it's one clue that cultural engagement might matter. We know from a range of literatures on inequality in education, and then a broad range of literatures, particularly coming from the United States, around how social inequality is replicated through a variety of different cultural means, that childhood cultural engagement matters. And what we found from our interview data set, we interviewed just over 230 cultural and creative workers from a variety of demographic categories and a variety of different career stages and a variety of different cultural and creative occupations. We found that levels of cultural capital, as we broadly define it, were really, really different. Childhood cultural life was really, really unequal. And there was a real kind of sharp differentiation between the experiences of what we might think of our kind of young elites, especially how they articulated the meaning of culture itself, let alone their engagement. And then those from working class origins who were much more directly dependent on what we might think of as kind of luck, random chance, you know, the sort of happy fortune of having access to culture provided by the state, or, you know, resources in schools. So to give a useful example of this, this is a comment from Lydia, who was in her 20s when we interviewed a white middle-class origin woman who was working as an artist. She, I think, was a really good example of how those from more privileged, those from professional managerial social origins had much greater cultural resources as children, but also how they thought about culture as well. So, you know, Lydia is telling us about, you know, going to art classes and, you know, it is sort of expressing a little bit of surprise, you know, well, everybody went to art classes, everybody's done paper mache at some point in their lives, you know, weekly trips to the museum. And also, I think importantly, a broad definition of culture, you know, playing board games as a cultural activity, there was always music playing, you know, the kind of stuff you imagine everybody does as a child, progression of influences, support, you know, that kind of stuff. And this was a real contrast to those from working class origins who would tell us, you know, their parents were encouraging, but maybe, you know, weren't really sure how to access cultural resources. You know, their parents might take them to the library if there was a local library. A particularly helpful teacher might have been encouraging, but, you know, this was uneven and unevenly distributed as compared to those, I guess, from the most well-resourced social starting points. Now, if inequality in childhood matters, then we might kind of develop this and think about other moments in the life course that are important. We talk a lot about, you know, sort of early careers, access to pay, access to opportunities, stuff like this. But what one of the things that I guess we haven't sort of focused on when we've been discussing the book and maybe has been, you know, kind of slightly missed from some of the coverage we've got for the book, is our work on gender inequalities, particularly the distribution of care and responsibilities. So this is a visualization of some data from the Office for National Statistics longitudinal study, which is a sample of the census linked together between 1971 and 2011. And we've got three cohorts, so, you know, three groups of people who are entering the cultural and creative workforce at different stages in their lives since 1981. So our first cohort enters the cultural creative workforce, and indeed the rest of the workforce, in 1981, when they're in their 20s and 30s. And what we can see is over the course of that 10 years, 81 to 91, there's a really high rate of attrition for everybody working in a cultural or creative occupation. You know, there's comparatively low percentages of people in the same occupation 10 years after they enter. But this is really differentiated by gender. So there are a much lower percentage of women as compared to men. This early 1980s set of entrants, the divisions, the kind of the differences are not as stark for those entering in 1991, and there are a range of, you know, possible explanations for that, not least of which is, you know, the broad kind of economic outlook at the beginning of the early 1990s, and as, you know, things, to coin a phrase, sort of get better under New Labour, and then, you know, a similar kind of smaller difference between those who entered in 2001. Now, these differences are not as pronounced when people are in their 30s and 40s and people are in their 40s and 50s. But it's clear that there are important distinctions and differences by gender for people who are leaving and people who are able to stay. And there is a range of different explanations that we go through in the book, but I'm going to pick up on one particular chapter from the book now, and that focuses on care work. Now, Stephanie, who is a working class origin white woman in her 30s working in museums, introduces this issue really, really nicely for us and connects directly back to my observation that it's, you know, slightly maybe strange to see a women-dominated set of museums, occupations in the Labour Force survey, because women aren't making it to the top of these professions. And you know, she describes senior management as men, junior curators are women, you know, seemingly, you know, these are wonderful working environments for women, but actually, you know, you're not quite taken, you know, sort of seriously. And, you know, she told us, unprompted, because we didn't ask specific questions about care work and having children, she told us, you know, she didn't have children, but actually she was worried, you know, about having children because she felt it would have a negative effect on her career. Not because, like other creative professions, like musicians, actors, you know, she would be told, well, you have to quit, you know, you can't possibly do this work if you've got a child, you know, and these explicit sexist or misogynist narratives, but rather, you know, she would be not taken seriously and would, you know, be kind of reduced to a category of a sort of, as she described, middle class dabbler who is not serious about pursuing her career if she's going to a kind of, you know, flexible working system that might be supportive of family life. I mean, it's really important, and we're, you know, we go in painstaking detail in the book to talk about how public policy in these areas has really foregrounded parenting and caring responsibilities as the single explanation for why women aren't making it to the top in, say, the film industry, the music industry, in museums, as visual artists or whatever. You know, we really need to say that isn't the case. But also, I think we need to do research that kind of raises or reinforces the issues that women are running into as parents that are not just to do with childcare, but are actually baked into what cultural and creative industries sort of think about work and think about labour conditions. So if Stephanie has given us, I suppose, a potentially negative impact on careers that is, you know, maybe subtle and institutionalised, we can see a much more, you know, kind of explicit range of issues. So, and we draw here on a range of feminist writers who have written about, I guess, you know, the kind of the failure of post-feminist discourses to get to grips with the impact on women's careers by just, you know, kind of framing things as being all to do with childcare, and also people like Tamsin Dent, Susan Berridge, a range of different writers who have pointed out, you know, focus on motherhood is slightly strange because it misses these broader kind of issues that attach to women as creative workers. And I'm going to elaborate on that after I've given you a bit more empirical evidence. So here's Jessica, white women in her 40s, working class origin, working in theatre. She told us when she was pregnant, you know, she was sort of slightly worried about doing the hours. You know, theatre is an extremely demanding part of cultural and creative industries. And her boss at the time said to her, well, you can't come back if you can't do the hours. You know, we'd like to think, you know, these kinds of interventions, you know, these kinds of working conditions would at least be, you know, kind of illegal or at least have legal sanctions, but partially to do with the way culture and creative labour markets operate, it's really difficult to resist. And this is a longer quote from her. She told us about, you know, it was manic, you know, it was really difficult, you know, 70 hour weeks plus having small children. And the reason we highlight this is because of this line that employers would say to her, but this is the job, you know, this job is this many hours, you know, and she was working these kind of crazy, you know, unsustainable hours. And she told us about, you know, not having seen her children and stuff like this. But I highlight this not, you know, to say, oh, well, if there was, you know, sensible childcare and flexible working hours, then, you know, that gap that we identify in the census data, in the longitudinal study data, would suddenly be closed. But rather because there's something here about what the job is and the way that employers or, you know, colleagues, co-workers are comfortable about narrating this kind of work in this kind of way as being not just exclusionary to, you know, women with parenting responsibilities, but actually to attach, I guess, a particular negative connotation to women in the context of particular positive connotations that go onto men. So to illustrate this, here's a comment from Jane, who was working in the music industry when we interviewed her. You know, she noticed cast and crew she was working with were single, childless, but the men had kids. And she found it really frustrating that actually, you know, men seem to be, you know, celebrated as being, you know, these heroes raising their kids and, you know, still making it in the music industry. And indeed, you know, she found, you know, an even sort of more pernicious form of sexism from particular male artists where they would be like, but you don't even have kids. You don't have the caring responsibilities that I do, even though, you know, we've got various sociological and economist studies talking about the uneven and gendered division of labor in parenting. And indeed, Tamsin Dent, who I whose work I flagged up earlier, has written really, really kind of insightful work about this in the film industry. And so we see these, you know, what we call, and drawing on the work of Nemal Puwar, her work on the British civil service, what we call a kind of a somatic norm in the cultural and creative industries. And we use this somatic norm idea in a variety of different ways throughout the book, particularly actually when it comes to thinking about the intersection of race, class and gender in who is, I guess, kind of assumed to be an appropriate individual to be a cultural creative worker, whether that's to get hired or to get funding, to get commissions. And then who is seen as other, who is constituted as a risk, and discourses of risk are, I think, are particularly, sort of offensive now as we see, you know, cultural labour markets, commissions, funding contracting, and those who don't fit a particular somatic norm being construed as risky, as something that, you know, might not be appropriate for support. Puwar's work looked at the civil service and she was trying to explain how it was that particular individuals dominated the civil service, the white male upper middle class body, this, you know, this sort of well known and actually is still with us today, even though she was writing almost 20 years ago, and she had a variety of explanations for how this somatic norm operated to reproduce racist, misogynist and classist spaces and patterns. We slightly modify that idea of a somatic norm. We still foreground whiteness, maleness and middle classness, but we also bring in a variety of insights from particularly actually American sociology of creative industries, Kottman's work, that tries to stress how our culture and creative workers are also defined by the embodied expression of being, open, liberal, meritocratic, having, kind of omnivorous cultural tastes and cultural expressions that, might manifest themselves through the way they dress, through their kind of choices in design and stuff like this. And this intersection of a well-established somatic norm that we might find in more, slightly less cool bureaucratic spaces with the, kind of set of cultural and creative, whether we call them ideologies or, attitudinal positions, manifests itself in the way that senior men narrate their understanding of cultural and creative industries and their understanding of cultural and creative labor markets. And this is, I think, an important contrast to the experiences of women, whether, parents or not. So, for example, Rachel, who's a working class origin woman of color, she's a Black British woman in her 50s, working in a variety of creative roles across the arts and music industries. She would tell us about, being the only Black person in the room, being shocked by that, having her race essentially kind of commodified for, funding proposals or, possible commissions, and, encountering what I guess we'd call a hostile environment in cultural and creative industries that are supposed to be, kind of open, meritocratic, that are supposed to be celebrating individual talent, not celebrating, or not commodifying or reducing individuals to the color of their skin. And again, she told us, she elaborated on this, talking about how, she would be encountering people who would quite candidly say, well, you're probably only getting this money because you're Black. Not just that, a kind of a reduction of potential creative opportunities to her race, but also going beyond that actually, to make her sort of, doubt herself, essentially being involved in a kind of continual struggle for recognition of her, both, the kind of quality of her work and indeed, the sort of legitimacy of that work as well. And this is a real contrast to those white middle class origin men who we might think of as our somatic norm in the cultural and creative industries. And we've alluded, I've alluded to this and we've alluded to this with some of the research already. So Andrew's experience of, say, getting a job wasn't of, commodification of his race or hostility. It was much more about, kind of chancing his arm, getting a bit lucky. It was about, as he described, kind of using his ignorance about a particular art form to show how he might be effective at marketing and kind of selling that particular art form to others who are, kind of unaware or not engaged. Again, a very different experience and indeed a very different set of assumptions from employers or commissioners. He was telling us how he recognized inequalities, how in his particular art form, it was clear that although lots of people were women, and there's a bit of a giveaway about what his art form is in that comment, all the famous choreographers are boys, women do the real work, men do the showy bits at the top, recognizing the kinds of patterns that we've demonstrated, I guess, sociologically earlier on in the book, and indeed others, you know, in this space have spent a long time drawing people's attention to. And I suppose sort of depressingly, whilst there's a moment of recognition of inequalities, they're not inequalities that are recognized, I guess, you know, for him. And I'll give you two examples of this. On the one hand, he thinks of cultural and creative industries as, you know, organizations that are doing better than other parts of the economy and other parts of society, because everyone's hearts are in the right places. You know, they want to do something meaningful, but they're not sure what that might be. In contrast, you know, to other occupations that maybe don't care about inequality and not taking gender and race seriously, and are not, you know, self-aware about, you know, questions of class, questions of gender, questions of race. But he is someone who had, you know, hiring responsibility and commissioning responsibility, sort of held up his hands and said, look, you know, there's basically nothing I can do, even, and this was unspoken, even though, you know, he was in this position of responsibility for shaping his organization's staff and you know, the cultural direction in some ways of his organization. So, you know, because of oversupply in the labor market, you're just going to pick whoever has the best education. And, you know, we can talk about how the best education equates to particular forms of social inequality. You know, in this case, we're, you know, talking about people who have been to highly unequal elite educational institutions. And indeed, you know, we can talk about diversity, but actually, you know, what you don't want to do is don't want to take a risk. And as a result, we're forced into maintaining the undiverse status quo. Partially, as Andrew says, because the damage is done before we get to the point where we can inflict any damage. So again, essentially a kind of a labour market supply narrative, you know, almost picking up on what I've been saying about, well, you know, things are so unequal when people are growing up. And, you know, the labour market is so oversupplied with these brilliant graduates from, you know, these highly unequal elite educational institutions, that there's nothing that I can do as someone making hiring decisions to change any of these social structures. But I think, and again, that last comment, I won't read that out, but that last comment sort of, you know, shows that as well. You know, well, if people were applying, obviously, you know, we'd appoint them, but they're not applying, so there's nothing I can do. But I think what's most worrying here is two things. One is the, I suppose, incorporation of critical sociological narratives to explain a lack of responsibility and a lack of action, and a sort of a structural narrative that almost kind of gets individuals off the hook for the kinds of inequalities that we show earlier in the book. And crucially, actually, these are not inequalities that are new. You know, whether we take the class stuff for 5 years, we've got class data going back using the longitudinal study for almost 40 years, and we've got a range of data that establishes class and race inequalities for a very long time as well. But I suppose, you know, even worse is not the right term, but, you know, rivaling that as a worrying development is that use or expression of a somatic norm and the attachment to risk. The idea that somehow those who are not from the best, you know, educational roots, you know, somehow that those who aren't, you know, white middle class, and in this case, for his art form, women, somehow that they are a risk that is, you know, emblematic, I think, of a deep-seated structural problem that goes beyond just, you know, giving people access or, you know, supporting people's funding, but actually speaks to, you know, broader sort of institutional sexism, racism and classism that attaches negative values to particular bodies, whilst others are, you know, if not, you know, kind of celebrated explicitly, but at least treated in a kind of neutral way as being the right kind of candidates who are a safe bet. And as I say, you know, as we reach this context of reduced funding, reduced opportunity, and a major recession facing Britain and Britain's cultural and creative industries in particular, I think this is the thing that we need to be, you know, guarding most forcefully against. And I'll stop there. I'll just stop sharing my screen.
Thank you, Dave. That was wonderful. So I'd like to invite the attendees to please pose your questions. So if you look at the bottom of your screen, you have the Q&A button. And so if you pop that open and please, you know, pose your questions to Dave about his really fascinating research. I know for myself, in my own work, I look at the similar inequalities in higher education and some of the sort of aversion to risk and the same sort of linguistic seems to pass across the two worlds. Granted, they crisscross quite a bit.
Yeah, there's actually really neat synergies, I guess, with a lot of the work on HE, and actually particularly for the sort of sector myself and my colleagues are interested in. Two lines, really. One is entry into places like Oxford and Cambridge and, you know, the kind of construction of talent and its, you know, really sort of obvious overlap with how we'd understand cultural capital, and then also entry to art school, where you get incredibly, like, you know, sort of just ridiculous statements about what talent is and, you know, who is talented and, you know, how you can kind of spot talent that maps on quite closely to themes of, are they basically just like the tutors who are letting them in, which, you know, this is crazy in some ways.
Yeah, we have a question coming in from Lisa Marks, which, yeah, do you observe differences between highbrow and more medium brow arts organizations, etc.?
Yeah, so this is really, really interesting, this, because there are like major issues talking about cultural and creative industries as a whole, you know, as a kind of discrete sector of economy and society. And those issues are, like, you know, some are technical and some are like unbelievably tedious. And debates have been going on for sort of like 20 plus years about this and about whether this category is useful. I think what was useful to us as a category was the ability to kind of spot similar patterns. And there are sort of balances to spotting these patterns. So, you know, your comment about higher education was really useful there, because at a macro level, what we're talking about, and indeed we've had some sort of quite RC peer reviewers who have said this, what we're talking about is essentially, here are social inequalities, you know, that might be true of like entry into top city firms. So Sam Friedman, Daniel Laurison's work, you know, we see parallels here. But what are kind of crucial differences over and above the consequences of, you know, having unequal cultural and creative industries that are different to the consequences of having unequal, say, city firms or even unequal access or entry to universities. Over and above those differences is the way that a particular kind of, I guess, you know, cultural capital or, you know, a particular kind of cultural and creative workers' attitude played out. And this was so interesting because it seemed to keep coming up irrespective of the brow that we were dealing with. So, you know, people who were working in design agencies would have similar kinds of narratives around, you know, sort of inequalities. The patterns in the film industry around, you know, class are really clearly different to the patterns in the publishing industry around class. The patterns, you know, in the publishing industry for gender are really different to the patterns for the publishing in the film industry for gender. But the attachment of a particular kind of vision of who should be, you know, an appropriate cultural and creative worker, attaching to, you know, a kind of white middle class man, seemed to keep coming up over and over again. But it all, you know, was kind of hidden or bound up or kind of wrapped up into this particular idea of you know, being, I suppose, like, you know, talented, being, you know, sort of meritocratic in making sure talented people made it, you know, being explicitly not like bureaucracies, not like, you know, bureaucratic organizations, these kind of things. So yeah, although there are definitely kind of, you know, important nuances and, you know, individual work that we've drawn on actually from, say, the fashion industry, showing, you know, how it's a distinctive set of, you know, freelance and micro businesses as compared with, say, museums and galleries that are these broader, larger institutions, is important to recognize. But overall, what was striking was more the kind of the similarity between the brands.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next two questions actually sort of are similar. So from Anthony Schrag and Tricia Coleman. So thank you for the presentation. So the first one is, do you think this is entirely addressed by policy, or is there a capacity for us to think of alternative mechanisms? Whereas Tricia asks about specific cultural institutions that are doing progressive work. So both sort of asking questions about sort of how this gets addressed.
Yeah, it's really tricky, this, because on the one hand, these are sectors that are often very hard to regulate. So a good example right in the moment is, you know, trying to get to grips with, say, the numbers of freelancers working in these areas. There are ways of doing that. It's unfortunate that the government, you know, hasn't been much more active in that space. But it's something that means that policymakers are often like, oh, you know, it's too complicated. You know, it's difficult to do, you know, sort of coherent policy for such a sort of, you know, disparate and often fragmented set of industries and occupations. At the same time, there are definitely things that policymakers could be doing in terms of, for those parts of the sector that are getting direct state support. So, you know, for example, if they're getting grants from the Arts Council or the British Film Institute, if, you know, they're in receipt of, say, tax breaks or tax credits or whatever, we could attach much stronger demands to those interventions. And also that needs to be matched by much stronger forms of kind of monitoring and enforcement. So again, you know, to give an example, the Arts Council has had a long-standing set of guidelines about unpaid internships and unpaid work. But, you know, recent research, so I think it's about 2 years ago, from the Institute of Public Policy Research, was suggesting that cultural industries, not just media, but also associated industries, you know, some of which are funded by Arts Council England, are basically like the worst for unpaid work and unpaid routes into work. And all of this means that, yeah, you know, strong policy interventions are really important. But I'm also really cautious, actually, of saying that, you know, regulation solves everything. And that's not for like crazy neoliberal reasons, but it's more because I think it is crucial that we celebrate pressure, both from audiences and campaigners, and we don't kind of relegate, you know, public demand, particularly in the kind of commercialized spaces of media, music, film, you know, these kind of areas, to just something that people are sort of powerless to change. And I think, so this is Trish's question, you know, things like online social media campaigning, you know, this is an unbelievably crude mechanism, but actually, you know, people's kind of, you know, market signals at the box office about, you know, films with poor representations, or, you know, films with kind of, you know, misguided plot lines or actor choices or whatever, are important and effective. And, you know, to a lesser extent, you know, money does kind of follow this. We're seeing, again, this is more in media, but it's coming up in our highbrow institutions as well, responses to the Black Lives Matter movement and moment to say, look, you know, we have to put funding into commissioning. Although, you know, what might be a worry here is that funding seems to be about early career first breaks. They're not about, you know, how do we make sure, you know, careers are sort of supported all the way through? And then there's smaller kind of campaigning organizations. So one actually that was really important to the book is an organization called Arts Emergency, which is essentially a way to try and recreate the levels of social capital that we'd find in particular kind of elite, if I can call them that, individuals, for those from working class or excluded occupations. So yeah, I mean, there are definitely organizations doing progressive work, and there are definitely, you know, things to celebrate over and above direct, I guess, kind of forms of regulation, particularly attached to funding and state support.
Great. Our next question comes from Thomas Lewis. You mentioned your use of American research informing your findings. Are there other similar studies in other countries, particularly those in Global South, and how do those findings differ?
Yeah, I mean, the temptation as an academic is always to be like, yes, you know, I've read this one paper and then I'll extemporize based on that. But actually, you know, I'm not the expert on that. So I would really like to comment other than saying people like Roberta Kinnunen at King's, Anna Lakovska at Copenhagen Business School have done a lot of work on this. I mean, we did draw a little bit on the consumption side. So there's been a lot of good work done in Latin America on patterns of cultural consumption, where you see, you know, kind of issues of kind of inequality and social elites. But yeah, I wouldn't like to comment too much on that.
Absolutely. Our next question is actually from an LSE student, so Victoria Kampf. She mentions, you know, observed one of the respondents that said no disabled person applied. I'm quoting her here. So I could imagine that many people at the managerial positions never thought about what could actually hinder disabled people from actually applying. Could there be strategies for institutions to actively reach out to disabled working class people, et cetera, so that they feel welcome and comfortable in the application process, so that entry point process?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky this. So I mentioned in my talk that we focused on class, race, and gender as our major demographic categories. And actually, you know, to link to the comments about research from the Global South, you know, we're sort of not experts on disability studies in culture and creative industries. And again, you know, there are various people who are doing this kind of work. So I'm sort of slightly cautious of saying this is how organizations should change, you know, to do better. In terms of class, I mean, I think there's a range of things, some of which are to do with how we think about jobs. And you know, unfortunately, we run into, I think, a system that assumes that, you know, every job at, say, the Royal Opera House is a kind of, you know, an opera house job, when actually there are many jobs that are just basically, you know, in need of particular transferable skills that, you know, are not about or just kind of, you know, standard that you might find in other large organizations. And so thinking about how and where you advertise those jobs, how you, you know, make clear what, say, the salary is, how you make clear what the job is, rather than kind of, you know, here's a chance to work in this elite institution, these kind of things are quite useful. And I mean, the literature is a bit debatable, and some of this is slightly anecdotal. More broadly, I think there is this kind of question of what is it about particularly kind of elite cultural institutions that they have, whether it's a kind of a reputation or, you know, they kind of give off a vibe or whatever, that means that people are not thinking about, oh, I could get a job there. And there's an example actually in the book of one of our respondents who went on to have a really, you know, quite stellar cultural career, whose first job was at a theatre, basically being a kind of admin assistant, and how, you know, she had never really thought about working in the theatre and had a really bad time when she got the job, because she was, you know, basically kind of bullied a bit because of not knowing the sort of hidden codes of the theatre industry, even though her job was essentially just, you know, kind of admin. And, you know, we shouldn't have to place the burden of changing institutions onto individuals. It should be institutions that are being more, you know, kind of hospitable through various things, various kind of organizational changes. And indeed, just to sort of round up on that, it's quite a long answer, but the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Creative Diversity, which is working in Parliament at the moment, is trying to think through some of these effective what works strategies for those sort of changes. And they're going to be publishing some stuff next year, but they do a sort of monthly blog on the Creative Industries Federation about these issues as well.
Great. I'm going to jump around a little bit here just because I noticed we have a question here about sort of the spatial aspect of inequalities. So the question is, how does London centricity figure into your account of these inequalities? And do you think more spatial dispersion of the creative and cultural industries would have an impact on these inequalities?
Yeah, so it's interesting this, and it's slightly tricky because there's a lot of things to say. Maybe I'll just pick three things to comment on that. The first thing is like, and I've alluded to this before, you know, the uneven economic geography of Britain is not just a cultural and creative industries problem. You know, the uneven economic geography of Britain is a catastrophic like state failure for, you know, getting on for hundreds of years kind of thing, or depending on which, you know, economic historians you sort of read and follow. And so, you know, this isn't just a kind of a, if we move Channel 4 to Leeds, that'll solve it. You know, it's something that's much more to do with how Britain is, you know, kind of economically organized. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, because of the kind of like the unique problems that London has with, you know, like, again, decades of poor planning, you know, an institutionalized housing crisis that, you know, various governments have sort of used to their kind of advantage in terms of getting votes from, you know, suburban voters and all of these kind of things. It means that London is, you know, effectively kind of quite a big accelerator for these inequalities. Not so much because you have to move to London to make it. Actually, you know, you can have, you know, quite a good and sustainable cultural and creative career outside of London, and there are various, you know, kind of routes that people take, and there are various bits of cultural infrastructure. And indeed, you know, it'll be interesting to see how things develop with working from home cultures for those things that aren't involving, you know, kind of live events or visitors or whatever. But for those who do, you know, either kind of move to London or are from London, they face much kind of stiffer competition. So, you know, it's not just a matter of paying really high rents and needing, you know, second or sometimes third jobs to support oneself versus those who have maybe got, you know, parental support, direct finance, you know, parental networks. But also, I think it's a question of the way that decision makers have assumptions about London. And this is my third point. So, you know, yeah, definitely, you know, having a more kind of even spread of locations for our creative clusters is important and will be useful. We have to risk not losing the kind of cluster effects that you get from lots of cultural and creative occupations and cultural and creative industries being really, you know, near each other. You know, it's not just a matter of kind of we should level London down to level other places up, obviously. But even if we did that, I wonder at the extent to which commissioners, decision makers, funders, etc., would still have assumptions about the legitimacy of London and the role it plays in individuals' careers.
So I'm realizing we have 5 minutes left and we have 11 questions. So I'm just going to jump around a little bit here. So from Asif Butt, we have, thank you for your presentation, and then two questions. So the first one, how were levels of cultural capital measured in your study? But the second one is, to what extent have unlimited subscription services such as Spotify, Netflix, changed the way we conceptualize and operationalize cultural capital?
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. We basically drew on taking part data, and we tried to think through a sort of a what we call like an emerging or, you know, new forms of distinction framework for cultural capital. You know, we certainly didn't just have that kind of classic Budgesian high and low division, because that's, you know, not really sort of appropriate to contemporary society, and indeed, actually, you know, contemporary Britain. Now, In terms of how that's changing, there's a couple of things to say on that, really. There's recent data from studies of how people have been accessing streaming services that are done by Nesta and the Intellectual Property Office that suggests that we still see a social gradient in access to these kind of digital methods. And we drew on Seamus Khan's work about how, the framework for understanding cultural capital shouldn't be about high and low, but it should be more to do with kind of modes of engagement and kind of attitudes and sort of a sense of openness. We don't talk about this too much in the book, but I'm just actually wrapping up a paper about this because we talked to our interviewees about how they understood legitimacy, taste, their kind of taste practices. And what was really interesting was we found really, strong evidence of this new form of distinction that legitimate cultural capital, measured in this case kind of qualitatively, was attached to not only particular cultural forms that weren't, kind of opera, ballet, etc., but were wrapped up in the idea of it's about, being kind of interested, invested. It's about how you engage. You should never be snobbish. It's about, expressing things through, a kind of open and tolerant mode. So yeah, I guess they're the two answers, drawing on quantitative data from attendance and participation data, but without a too strong kind of hierarchy. Mark is the expert on this and kind of he did the MCA work for, kind of understanding our version of cultural capital. And then, yeah, actually the digital stuff, it's not really changing cultural capital and how we conceptualize it, because that change, I think, around, orientations, modes of engagement has happened already, really.
Very interesting point there, yeah. So just trying to choose one final question for us to wrap up with. Well, you can see the questions as well, so if there's one question you'd really like to address.
I'm just seeing if there are any like really easy ones.
Those are great questions.
Oh, actually, I'll maybe the last one, because it's about measurements.
Yeah.
I'm interested in measurement. So yeah, so improving class inequality, and people say there's no agreed way to measure. I actually think that's a really important point, and this is a way of sort of highlighting work that the Social Mobility Commission are doing at the moment, which is trying, and also the Gerwood Charitable Bursaries Program are doing, which is trying to get organizations not so much to like agree on this is how you measure social class, and this is how, you should kind of do it by being told, but more kind of going through a process of thinking what's the appropriate way for our organization to conceptualize these problems. I do think, and this, comes from the data in the book, but also some work across the sector. The organizations are concerned about this, and so are individuals. But I do think, your anonymous attendee is right that they tend to say, oh, we can't possibly measure this. And if we pick one thing, someone on social media will say, oh, that's wrong, so you shouldn't do it, or whatever. But really, actually, in these kind of spaces, we should be, talking through these are the decisions we've made to try and, whether it's measure, evaluate, get more data. We've made these decisions for these reasons. There are trade-offs with everything. I mean, where I started, I talked about trade-offs with the ONS labor force survey data and, how you drill down and how you don't. So yeah, I think the fear that, that we're going to see counterintuitive things in the data, I'm not really getting that from organizations. I think the fear is more actually to do with we'll do this thing wrong and it'll be a disaster, which, in some ways it is a bit of a shame.
Great. Well, it is 1:30. Thank you everybody for joining us. And thank you especially to Dave O'Brien. This was really insightful. And I'm looking forward to digging in deeper into your book to sort of seeing how the sort of nitty gritty of this plays out in your work.
No,
so
thank you
very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.